Good morning. This is the traditional gospel for the second Sunday of Lent. In the new liturgy, you know, the past 40 years, we've had a different version of it, Matthew, Mark, or Luke each year, depending on what cycle we're in. But the Transfiguration has, as far back as we can trace the Roman liturgy, been the gospel for the second Sunday of Lent. Why? What is it doing in this liturgical location? Doesn't seem to fit, does it? I mean, it is a revelation of Christ's glory from beginning to end. Doesn't that have more to do with Easter than with Lent? Shouldn't we have something else in here where Jesus is encouraging prayer or penance or something like that? But this is the one we've always had. And it is clearly about the revelation of Christ's glory. He was transfigured. The Greek is literally transformed. Go back to Paul, the letter to the Philippians. Though he was in the form of God, he did not deem it to be something to be clung to. He transformed himself. Well, now he's transformed back. Kids understand that with a toy that they call Transformers, but it's a little more serious than that. But his face shone like the sun. This is not a reflection. In Christian art, ever since, this has been depicted with Jesus' face being the source of light. This is not the glory of God shining on the face of Christ, as Paul says. This is the glory of God shining from the face of Christ, the divine presence within, is manifest visually. And even his clothes are so transformed by the glow from within that they become as white as light. This is an overwhelming experience. Peter said, it's good that we are here. Literally, he says, it is beautiful that we are here. And it is indeed a revelation of Christ's glory. And placing him in context with Moses and Elijah, establishing him as the new Moses, the maker of the new covenant. It's on a mountain, right? And Moses and Elijah show up. These are the only two figures in the Tanakh who met the Lord at Mount Sinai. We had a face-to-face encounter with God on the holy mountain. And they show up. They're also symbolic, of course, of the law and the prophets that testify to this. So all of this build-up here. And while he was still speaking, Peter, that is, a bright cloud cast a shadow over them. Think about that one. I mean, in Mark it says a cloud. Matthew adds a bright cloud. What's a bright cloud? I thought a cloud was by definition darkness, and that's why they cast shadows. But this is a bright cloud, and you wouldn't expect a bright cloud, if it was a bright cloud, to cast a shadow at all. But a bright cloud casts a shadow over them. The Shekinah. The cloud of God's presence. That dwelt in the tent in the desert, that followed them from Sinai throughout their wandering. The presence of the Lord that is a radiant, a bright cloud. We're clearly being shown Jesus expressing the glory of God. Beautiful reading. But why here? Well, there are a few clues. First of all, the location in the gospel. This occurs immediately after the first prediction of the passion. Matthew follows Mark in this order. Jesus has been confessed by Peter in practically the same words that God uses. I mean, in Mark, it's very limited, that you are the Messiah. But in Matthew, as we'll see later in the summer, it's much more expansive. You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. But then, immediately, Jesus begins to tell them, we're going up to Jerusalem. The Son of Man will be handed over to the sinners and will be put to death. And Peter says, oh, no, 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 no. And Jesus says, oh, yes. And if you wish to be my disciple, you must take up your cross and follow me. And then immediately, this passage. So it's put in that context to reach God's glory with Jesus. We must go through Jesus' passion. And then there's a clue at the end. Do not tell this vision to anyone until the Son of Man has been raised from the dead. Raised from the dead. That puts it in context, doesn't it? What you're seeing is the glory of the risen Christ. And you're not allowed to talk about it until Christ is risen. Until he has been raised from the dead. Which obviously means that he has gotten dead in the meantime. This is set in the context of the Passion. And there's some deeper clues inside. The voice says, this is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. Listen to him is added by Matthew, and that's another part of the glory thing, because that suggests Deuteronomy, where God says to Moses, I will raise up a prophet like you among my people, and to put that person, the people must listen, and anyone who does not listen to the prophet will be cut off from the people, and so on. Jesus is the prophet like Moses. But the other two sound good on the surface. This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. But listen to it with a first century Jewish ear. This is my beloved Son. Literally, this is the Son of me, the beloved. That's identical phrase except changing of me to of you. To the way they translated Genesis 22. And God said to Abram, take the son of you, the beloved, and journey to a place that I will point out to you and offer him as a sacrifice. Those words in that particular order would not have been lost on their ears. Jesus is being cast in the role of Isaac, who is to be sacrificed. It gets almost ominous on that, doesn't it? The parallels, the irony. When Abraham is asked to offer his son, at the end, God is there to tell him it doesn't have to happen. When it is God's son, God's turn to offer God's son, there's no one there to say it doesn't have to happen. This is the one who will give his life. My son, the son of me, the beloved, with whom I am well pleased. Isaiah chapter 42, verse 1, uses exactly the same language. This is my pais, this is my child, my servant, depending on which translation of it you take, the word's ambiguous. This is my servant with whom I am well pleased. This is the beginning of the suffering servant songs. In Isaiah, the songs about the one who will give his life for the people, who will be made to suffer so that Israel may be saved. That enigmatic figure has always been sort of hanging out there. And now it's called to mind right in the announcement. This is the Son of me, the beloved, in whom I am well pleased. Between the Genesis allusion and the Isaiah allusion, that is not an entirely, it's not the kind of statement that you will want made about you. It sounds pretty good, but the implications are pretty ominous. And we've just been told that not only is that what's going to happen to Jesus, but we need to participate. Take up your cross and follow me. That's what's ambiguous about mountains. It's not by accident that this happens on a mountain. Israel met God on a mountain. There are mountaintop experiences to be had. We go up on the mountain and we experience God's glory revealed in the face of Christ. But also, when you get up on a mountain, in addition to looking up to heaven and knowing how close you are to God, you look out. You can see almost forever. And you know that's where you have to go. What seemed like one day's journey at a time when you were doing it. From the mountaintop, it stretches before you almost forever. And you know that's where you have to go. You have to come back down the mountain, shoulder your load, and continue with the journey. We have to take up our cross and follow Christ. We are invigorated by the experience. We're emboldened by the vision of Christ's glory. We're given courage by the thought that that is our glory as well. That who He is in that moment of revelation is who we shall become. That's a glorious moment. It's why this scene has been so popular, and especially monastic art in the Eastern Church. Over the arch, for instance, as you enter the main chapel of the monastery at Sinai, one of the oldest and holiest monasteries in the world, is not a picture of the crucifixion, but a picture of this scene, the transfiguration. This icon is particularly meaningful because it reveals the end of the journey for Jesus and the end of the journey for us. We are to be transformed from glory into glory, and God's glory will shine out of us as it does out of Christ. But, and it's a very real but, Christ gets there only by going up to Jerusalem. It is from Mount Tabor to Mount Calvary that the journey lies. And it was true for Him, and it will be true for us. And so this mountaintop experience for the journey of our faith cuts both ways. It gives us a glorious revelation of our goal and a sobering thought about the journey to get there. When you get to the mountain, look up, but also look out. Sisters and brothers, let us pray.